This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm C.P. Leslie, taking a break from my normal focus on historical fiction to host this episode of New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Russell E. Martin about his latest book, The Tsar's Happy Occasion, Ritual and Dynasty in the Weddings of Russia's Rulers, 1495 to 1745. Russell Martin is a professor at Westminster College in Pennsylvania. He has written, edited, or translated 10 books, including two on Muscovite and Imperial Russian weddings and the bride shows leading up to them, and one on the art of Konstantin Makovsky, a painter known for his depictions of 16th and 17th century nobility. In addition, he has authored many articles on those and other life stage rituals in Muscovite life. For more than 20 years, he has advised the Russian imperial house, the Romanov dynasty, on various legal and historical issues, and he is the lead translator for the dynasty's official webpage. As a fellow specialist in Muscovite history, I am delighted to have read first his A Bride for the Tsar, then this new book, and I look forward to sharing it with you. So without more ado, please join me in welcoming Russell E. Martin. Hi, Russ. Thank you for agreeing to talk with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the Tsar's happy occasion, please give us a short summary of A Bride for the Tsar, Bride Shows, and Marriage in Early Modern Russia. Let me know if anyone who wants to learn more about that book can do so by searching for your name on the newbooksnetwork.com site. And that's one word, New Books Network.
Yeah, thank you for that plug of the other book. It might be thought by some people to be kind of a prequel to this book, but it really isn't. While the present book is The Tsar's Happy Occasion is really a book about ritual and kind of anthropology of power. The earlier book, Bride for the Tsar, really is about power and has a completely different focus, not just in terms of what the topic of the book is, which is the politics of picking a bride for the Tsar in the early modern period, but also sort of the tool set that I used, which is completely different from what I did with Tsar's Happy Occasion. Bride for the Tsar really comes out of, asking the question that has been asked actually, but never really sort of answered by my colleagues and predecessors in the field. Why did the Russian Tsars pick and Grand Princes pick their brides? And why is there this repeating reference in the sources to this fascinating thing called bride shows? Where a number of eligible young women were presented to the Tsar, and he sort of picked who he wanted to marry as if it were a genuine love contest or beauty contest, and completely open and free of any politicking. And in fact, what the book goes about to show is that, in fact, it wasn't an open contest. It was quite political in its in its processes and in its goals. And it more than that, it really was a gateway to understanding the nature of the political system in Muscovy, early modern Russia, in that it kind of both at the same time facilitated and concealed dimensions of the monarch's power. I certainly am in the group of the school of thought, if you like, that argues that this traditional view of monarchical power in Russia was autocratic, top down. The Tsar owned the people and the land, could do anything he wanted. And counter to that, I'm among those who say that's probably just not true. It never was true, certainly in the early modern period. Power was more collaborative, limited, built on consensus politics, and all facilitated by marriage. Now, there had been scholars who had come before me. Nancy Shield Coleman comes to mind, but also Ned Keenan, who had put the focus on the marriages of the boyars, all the great nobles around the Tsar, and showed, I think, established that, in fact, marriage was what this political system was all about. It facilitated position and place and honor at court. No one had ever asked the question, well, what about the Tsar's marriage, which is clearly the linchpin of it all? So this book really was about trying to investigate how the Tsars picked their brides and how they concealed that process, how they concealed, in a sense, that collaborative, limited nature of monarchy in order to project a very different image of the autocracy. And unfortunately, you know, it seems to me that generations of historians have sort of bought the story and not looked a little closer at the nature of power, which, you know, in the early modern period, not just in Russia, but everywhere, is facilitated by court rituals. Court rituals was the language. It was the sort of internet. It was the PR firm for everything that monarchies, and not just monarchies, the church played obviously a key role too, and developing rituals. It was about rituals. So the book really was sort of teasing that out and really looking at these beauty contests as highly choreographed moments that were serious, taken very serious. They weren't just facades, even if the message was insincere. The politics behind them was really quite deadly serious. Now, in this new book on the Tsar's Happy Occasion, it takes it to the next step. It really explores, well, what happens once the bride has been picked? How does ritual and power and women, royal women, and sort of the court, the nature of the court, the relationship between Tsars and their nobles, play out in the symbolism and meanings of the rituals themselves. And so that required really kind of looking at it from a very, very different perspective, from a sort of methodological perspective. I had to really school up on the anthropology of gift giving, for example. I had to school up on the anthropology of rites of passage, of which is an enormous literature. Much of it not on Russia, but just the theoretical material out there is enormous. So it's not really, in a way, a sequel to The Bride for the Tsar, the first book, because it really is, although it is, in a sense, the next thing that happens, it's really a very, very different book in terms of what's going on behind the scene. And so politics is there. There's no doubt that a theme that runs through the book is power. It's one of the major themes of the book, but it isn't the principal sort of target that I'm after. I'm really trying to say more things and actually to sort of fill in some blanks too from the previous book, which, you know, include the role of royal women in the Muscovite political system. Ironically enough, the book on bride shows doesn't really deal with women very much, even though they're at the center of the title of the book and of the purpose, of the rituals. This book here, though, really does bring women into the center. Women are in every chapter of the book, and in one book on gift giving is really focused almost entirely on women. So they're complementary books in a way. They could be read together, probably should be, but that's probably hoping for too much.
I think that's a good way of summarizing it. I mean, there is a real distinction between them, and I saw that. You do begin your introduction with the wedding of the future emperor and empress, Peter III and Catherine the Great, in 1745. The future Catherine the Great, of course. But this is the last wedding in the book that is typical of the points that you're making. So what makes this occasion emblematic of Muscovite and early 18th century weddings? Or is the point really that this is a new departure?
Yeah. You know, when I was a graduate student, I took a class from John Clive, who was a wonderful, wonderful professor at Harvard and taught a course called Classics of Historiography. And I remember very vividly, in fact, I wrote it down that, you know, he said, you always look at the first and last lines of anything that you're reading, that a good writer will dovetail those things. So I tried to do that as much as I can as a kind of silent tribute to the man. And he died just a year after I took his class. It was really far too soon for the man. And I, you know, I venerate his memory, and I learned a lot from him about writing by reading the books that he assigned to us. And so, you know, when I was looking at this, how to write this introduction, I knew I wanted to use this Lomonosov ode, which was written for the wedding of the future Peter III and Catherine II, because it really just so nicely illustrated all the themes, or almost all the themes, that I wanted to discuss in the book. So that's how I wanted to start the book. And then it, of course, meant that I needed to talk about that wedding in 1745, which was perfect because that was where I was going to end. You know, I have to say that was where I was going to end, I think. When I was first beginning the book, I really didn't know where I wanted this book to stop. One impulse was to take it all the way to 1801 or 1797, when the law of succession, the new law of succession by Paul I was promulgated. And I thought that would be a good place to do it. But this book tracks two themes. It really does, you know, it's sort of like a double helix. It really is about weddings, and which is to say ritual, and it's about dynasty. Those two themes are really what are the core, and everything else is linked to it. So gifts, brides, power, sacrality of monarchy, orthodoxy and heterodoxy, all of the other themes sort of hinge on weddings and ritual. So what I found was that in 1745, I get the wedding that sort of, for which I have the best documentation in the 18th century. The later weddings in the 18th century, ironically enough, less well documented. Also 1745, this Catherine the Great's wedding, is understudied. So it was a good thing to not go any further than that in order to put some emphasis on that, on what I was doing with it. But also the wedding themes sort of drop off at that point. The dynasty theme does go on. And I say a few words about that in the conclusion, all the way to 1797 and a little bit further even. But the two as a set sort of part ways in 1745. So that's the reason why I thought that was a good way to stop. And I'll also tell you this, you know, it was a tactical decision. I want people to read my book who are not early modernists. I want the modernists to read this book. Starting with, you know, with Peter and Catherine is a way to draw them in. Everybody wants to read about Catherine, of course. She's such a pivotal, fundamentally important figure in Russian history. And so it was a sort of writing decision, thinking back of Clive, on John Clive again, of how to draw the reader in and to dovetail the book into a kind of coherent, coherent and beginning and end, naturally beginning and ending kind of story that had a natural denouement at the end. So that's what I was thinking.
Let's leap back now, two centuries and a bit, to the first marriage that you cover in depth, which is that of Vasily III of Moscow, who is not yet a czar, but grand prince, the father of the future Ivan the Terrible. And he married Princess Elena Glinskaya in 1526. So just for starters, the wedding itself is a slightly scandalous event. So who are the protagonists and why is it controversial?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating moment because this wedding is not only the very first wedding that gives us a new template of a new document in the new documentary genre, let me say, but also is the end, or maybe the midpoint, really, of an enormously significant scandal in the court. And the scandal is that the Grand Prince Vasily III. Married in 1505. And by the way, his first marriage was the first bride show as well. And 1505, just before his father, Ivan III, dies. And that marriage with Solomonida Saburova lasts for 20 years, but it produces no children. As far as we know, not even any stillbirths, no activity at all. At a certain point, the Grand Prince is prevailed upon, and probably knows it himself, that he has to move on. He has to remarry in order to have another chance at producing the next generation. And, as Ned Keenan once put it in one of his articles, there's simply no other duty of a monarch that is more important than producing the next generation of viable males who can succeed to the throne. Policies aside, personalities aside, wars and diplomacy aside, the most fundamental requirement is to produce the next generation of rulers. And he wasn't. Vasily III wasn't. And so he needed to send his wife kicking and screaming off to a convent, which she is. Her becoming a nun essentially ends, not essentially, but actually ends the marriage. It's not really a divorce. It's the Orthodox Church provides for spouses to enter monasteries and to become nuns or monks. Typically, that's done when both do it. In this case, only the wife was doing it. And so there was another bride show quickly after that, and Yelena Glinskaya was picked, and he marries her in 1526. This produced, however, an enormous backlash of high-ranking boyars and even members of the church who believed that this ending of the marriage between Vasily III and Solomonida was illegitimate. And a lot of texts written later, actually, in the 16th century, not from that time, but reflecting pretty well some of the attitudes of the time, predicted bad things would result from this marriage. And then, of course, we get Ivan the Terrible, the elder of the two sons of this marriage, doing all the nasty things he does. So the wedding itself is interesting, but the important thing about that, and the interesting thing about that, is that that scandal finds no real reflection in the ritual in 1626. So the wedding goes off well enough. There are people you would have expected to be at the wedding in prominent positions of honorary positions of service who are not. And the reason why they're not is because they've opposed the Grand Prince, and some of them have been sent away in disgrace. A couple of them treated very, very forcefully, harshly. And so they're not there. And that's the sort of curious thing. But the wedding itself goes off in terms of the collection of rituals themselves without a hitch. In every way, it is a traditional wedding, as best as we can construct weddings before that. And we can only see weddings before that in bits and pieces because, as you said, 1526 is the first time we actually get this creation of a new document, a chin, a svadibni chin, or a ceremonial, wedding ceremonial, which is a document that very in increasing detail over the century describes the series of events, the speeches, the people who were involved. And that document, written in 1526, becomes the model for weddings throughout the 16th century. It's interesting because, you know, the 16th century is packed with a lot of wedding controversy. Not just Vasily the Third's second wedding, which was bad enough, but then Ivan the Terrible comes along and he marries seven times. And the sixth time he marries someone who had been previously married. And so the whole ritual, we don't have a document for that, but we have a few passing comments about that sixth wedding. But other than that one, we do have wedding descriptions for the seventh, for the third, and for the first, and for the fifth. So we can actually compare across Ivan's life and multiple marriages how these rituals were performed. And the striking thing about that, and I talk about this in the book at some length, is that the rituals themselves do not change. What changes is that in the later reign of Ivan the Terrible, you get many more in-laws and in-laws of in-laws packing the positions, the honorific positions in the wedding itself. Positions that would have normally been smeared out among all the members of the court were sort of bundled together and handed off to the in-laws, to the new in-laws, which is to say the bride's uncles and brothers and cousins. And that is a departure. And of course, these are the later years of Ivan's reign, or really the years of the Oprichnina, which, you know, is this unique and still poorly understood period of a few years, 7-8 years in Ivan's reign that that turned everything upside down. I'm actually hesitant to actually say what the Oprichnina is. What I can say is that there are very clear ritual reverberations that something odd has happened in the court. So this isn't the study of the Oprichnina, or even this chapter isn't the study of the Oprichnina, but it does throw light on the Oprichnina in the sense that we can sort of see the ritual effects of it playing out in Ivan's reign. But the point though, that's really even more important than that, I think, is that despite all the multiple marriages of Ivan, and let's remember too that his son, Tsarevich Ivan Ivanovich, marries three times too. And we actually have one of the descriptions of his marriages, his first, which is patterned almost verbatim on the 1526 wedding of Vasily III. So really what that means is that we have a really stable template, despite this amazing controversy going on in the 16th century. We really have a stable template for how a czar is supposed to marry, all the way up into really the turn of the 17th century when the first false Dmitri marries and he begins significant revisions. And then we get the Romanovs who do even a lot more than that. So the interesting thing is that stability and why it remains stable. Why doesn't Ivan tinker with it? And my speculation on that is, and it can only really be that, is that, you know, Ivan knew that he was playing with fire by marrying so many times. The canons of the church require or allow only three marriages, and even then with penance for numbers 2 and 3. No question about 4, 5, and 6. And in fact, there are Byzantine and even Russian prohibitions and just explorations, canonical explorations, of why you can't have a fourth marriage, let alone 5, 6, and 7. So Ivan really needed these 4, 5, 6, and 7 to be very, very traditional weddings, in order to sort of put a stamp of legitimacy on them, so that if any children would be born of them, there would be no question of their legitimate status. So there's a use here of ritual, by approaching the problem of the Apetian and Ivan's reign through the prism of ritual, we can actually throw some light on some more general questions, I think.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
That's a really interesting point. We're going to move on to the 17th century in just a minute, but for the sake of people who, unlike me, have not been buried in these sources, and you even more, can you tell us just a little bit about what the stages of the ritual itself were? Because it's a bit more than a trip down to the local registrar's office and the and the big party afterwards in the Soviet-style version.
Yes, it is. In the 16th century, it's a three-day affair. And in the 17th century, it quickly becomes a four-day affair, and even in a five-day affair when it comes to Alexei Mikhailovich's second wedding in 1671. So 3 days. And that's just the wedding. That's not throwing in also the bride show, which could happen a week to 6 weeks in front of the wedding. So the wedding itself... 3 days, and then the first day is really the most crucial in the sense that it's when the wedding happens. It's when the bride and the groom become husband and wife. And on that first day, you get a banquet, you get the church wedding, you get the key speeches, you get gift exchanges, all in the hands of the bride, or mostly. And that first day, entirely, gift exchanges happen from other people on days 2 and 3, but the first day it's really the bride's day. So what happens is the bride and groom are separate in the Kremlin. The bride had been introduced into the Kremlin in a ceremony that I like to call the entry into the Kremlin or entry into the terem. We don't have any descriptions of it. It was very clearly a ritualized event where she's installed, usually with some of her female kin in the terem. The terem being the apartments inside the Kremlin complex, palace complex, specifically designed for women, and it still exists today. It's actually a remarkable thing to go and see. Really well preserved. She would be in the terem. The groom would be in his palace, his residential palace. And then the groom would send to the bride a message: please go to the banquet hall. And she would, and she would process there with the women folk led by a high-ranking boyar, and she would take her seat at a banquet table. At that point, someone would go from the banquet hall to the tsar and say that it's time to attend to the wedding. It's time to come, and he does. He comes and he enters the room. He gets a blessing from the priest. He greets people. He sits down next to the bride. And after a very short time there, they then process to the wedding, also right next door in one of the cathedrals inside the Kremlin, and then they are married. Interestingly, our sources don't really describe much about what happens at the wedding because, and this has actually been an interesting problem because a lot of people have looked at this in the past, have said, well, the court sources only describe what happens outside of the wedding, the church wedding. It describes all of these banquets, all of these fertility rites and so on, but it never describes what's going on inside the church. What my response to that has been, well, it didn't need to. What happens in the church is prescribed. There's a source called the Trebnik, or back then called Potrebnik, that included the ordinaries of the service, and you didn't need to repeat it. There was a služebník for that purpose. At any rate, they go in and they have their wedding. They come back out. There's a procession, very long procession with a wedding train involved with it back to the wedding hall. And then there they have their wedding banquet. Interestingly, everybody eats except for the bride and groom. They're then led to the door after sitting around and watching and some speeches and prayers. They're then led in the middle of the meal, before everyone is done, to the door, the exit of this hallway. This banquet hall. And there a portal ceremony takes place where they're poured over with, you know, sprinkled with hops, very clear fertility symbol going all the way back for centuries, and then led to the bridal chamber where they're again sprinkled with hops and then allowed to go into the bridal chamber and consummate the wedding, the marriage. And then the banquet is still going on, right? And then food is brought to the couple in their bridal chamber. And they have their meal after they've consummated the marriage. We know this, that day two begins with a purification bath, where the bride and the groom separately go to baths, and frankly, they wash off the evidence of their marriage, and they are attended by male and female, respectively, attendants. It's a very great honor to be appointed to do that. They're given new clothes, brand new clothes that has never been worn before. This is usually a gift from the bride's father. And then there are other banquets. There are other gift exchanges. There are other audiences. And then on the third day, additional audiences are performed, this time with lower ranking servitors, sometimes middle class, and all, the middle class is the sort of merchants and so on inside Moscow are brought in, and then also churchmen from afar, from the reaches of Russia are brought in, and they bring gifts and they offer prayers. They bring documents that show that commemorative prayers are being performed way out in the regions. And in the 17th century, a fourth day is added. What happens is that the audience with the clergy on the third day in the 16th century is moved to a later day in the 17th century to give it more prominence, actually. So one of the things that this book tries to do is to interpret how these rituals change over time. And by looking at the changes in them, to try to deduce what the meaning of the ritual politically was. So for example, in the 16th century, when Moscow was ruled by the Danilovich dynasty, descended from Alexander Nevsky through his son Daniil Moskovsky. This is the dynasty that gives us Ivan III, Vasily III, Ivan IV, Ivan the Terrible. In that period of the 15th and 16th centuries, let's say 16th century because that's what we can document, it was part of a wedding ceremony for the groom after the wedding, on the first day after the wedding, to go and visit the churches of the Kremlin and to perform a panihida, a service, a commemorative service for his dead ancestors. He usually went with a very large assemble of people, and it was another large service. Panihida isn't a long service, maybe 40 minutes, but it was done publicly in a sense because you had to sort of process to the church to have it performed. And you were doing this in the church, St. Michael's, where the tsars were buried, right? So the grand prince's ancestors, direct ancestors, were right there. And you were offering a panihida for all of them. Basically, it was a dynastic moment. It was a time when the current groom was asking for prayers and offering prayers to his dead ancestors. And for his dead ancestors, at the moment that he was about to produce the next generation of these, you know, of this dynasty. So it was clearly a dynastic moment. What's interesting is that in the 17th century, of course, the tsars of the 17th century are not descendants from the Danilovich dynasty that gives us, you know, Ivan III, Vasily III, and Ivan IV. It's a completely different dynasty. It's the Romanovs. They're related, of course, by marriage to the old dynasty, but they're not descended from it. And so what you see is that in the 17th century, starting in 1624, the very first Romanov royal wedding, Michael Romanov, the first Romanov czar, is that this all-important mini pilgrimage is moved. It's moved to before the wedding in the morning. It's in fact now moved to make it the first public sort of moment of the wedding. The first thing that people would see would be the Tsar not going to his wedding at the church as was the case in the 16th century. But now in the 17th century, the first thing people would see inside the Kremlin was the Tsar going to pray for dead ancestors. But they weren't his ancestors, right? They were predecessors, but not ancestors. And yet that element is still there. It's interesting. You might think that they would just remove the element since, you know, these weren't their direct ancestors. They'd somehow commemorate this differently. But in fact, what you find, I think, is a fiction where the new dynasty was claiming sort of across the gap of the time of troubles, the old dynasty is as its own through prayers. And this was a very important message because the Romanovs were just really in 1624, you know, just 11 years on the throne. Nobody really knew that the Romanovs were going to be the final solution to the succession problem that was posed in 1598 with the extinction of the Danilovich dynasty, the dynasty of, you know, Ivan III, Vasily III, Ivan IV. That dynasty is gone. You needed to get a new one. It took them 15 years to figure it out. The Romanovs are there. We now know that the Romanovs succeed, but they didn't. And I guess it's really important to emphasize, that the, you know, one of the key points of this book is that the Romanovs succeeded as a dynasty. And these crucial first decades of their rule, not just Mikhail Fyodorovich's reign, but also Alexei Mikhailovich's reign, the first two Romanovs, precisely because, I argue, they were masters at manipulating and exploiting ritual for their own dynastic purposes.
And so, yes, I mean, 11 years in wasn't much of anything after the extent of the troubles that they had had.
That's right. It we have to sort of always, you know, this is just generally true. We always have to fight the great sin of teleology. We know how it works out, but we can't bring that knowledge into the work. We have to assume that the people that we're studying didn't know. And so they're pulling out all stops. And that's interesting to us because in doing so, they're broadcasting to us through the sources what was important to them. And so I think, you know, this kind of highly detailed analysis of rituals really is, I think, the entryway into understanding concepts and values and priorities that the Muscovites weren't saying explicitly in other documents or in memoirs or in letters or whatever, but they're still telling us this because they are making decisions. They are making changes, and they're not doing it because, you know, somebody's bored with the way it was. These are actually crucially important changes that you don't make unless you're trying to project a certain message. And so, to me, when I look at the extensive documentation, frankly, royal weddings are better documented than any early modern court event. Better documented in coronations. Better documented than ambassadorial receptions, anything, name day celebrations, processions to monasteries. Royal weddings have the largest number of folios that are still extant. And I think that's because they spent a lot of time on them. They needed to get it right. And what was right, quote unquote, was a moving target. even though, as you say, as I said before, the in the 16th century, you have an awful lot of stability. That's because the dynasty is set, and even though it's being tugged and really challenged in terms of Ivan's marriages and Patrician and other stresses on the system, it holds because the dynasty is still there. It's only when the dynasty dies out that you have to pull yourself up by the bootstraps and figure out how to continue moving the system on. And ritual is the way to do that. You know, when I was writing, I was thinking an awful lot about how it is, at my college where I teach, we've had deans who have been hired from the outside. Okay. And we've had deans who have been my colleagues and we're appointed. We have one right now. It's a pretty good dean, but yesterday he was my colleague, my equal in a sense. In fact, I made full professor before him. Now he's the dean. And that brings along a subtle change in your relationship to the person, how you talk to the person. Multiply that by 10 when you see boyars, especially from very illustrious old families like the Shuiskys, now having to, bang their forehead on the ground before somebody who was once, just yesterday, their equal. That's got to be tough. And so in order to make that palatable, you have to create fictions. You have to create, through the tool set that you have, which is largely ritual, a justification for behaving this way over someone you know, at the end of the day, doesn't deserve it, right? The only reason why you give that person the deference is because if you don't, a lot of worse things will happen. And so this, the interesting problem of changing dynasties, Pavlov has just written a wonderful 2-volume book on Michael Romanov's reign. Frankly, the first book, serious book about that reign, is the 1620s and 30s, is that I can remember. This is a fundamental problem about how this new dynasty was able to succeed. We all talk about, the Romanovs in the 19th century, Nicholas II and all that, the Russian Revolution, on all the enormous personalities, Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, Alexander II. But in fact, it's the two least known Romanovs who did all the heavy lifting for everybody else, in that they died in their beds as czars rather than, in a Lobnaya Miesta in Red Square being executed, which was kind of a possibility.
It was a possibility. And of course, we are so cut off from this way of looking at the world that we don't think about how important birth and heritage were in the 16th century everywhere, not just in Russia. But, the Shuisky princes actually thought they were superior to the Danilovichi because they were of an older line and, higher in their own minds. And so now they've got these Romanov boyars who are being advanced in front of them. And they're just one example. There were many other clans that had similar theories of their own legacies, in some cases made up and in some cases quite legitimate. But nonetheless, the Romanovs had a lot of heavy lifting to do, as you mentioned. I'd like to get back for a minute to one of the things that the Russians were quite explicit about, is that they wanted Tsars and Tsarissas who were Orthodox Christians and not Catholic Christians. And one of the issues with even behind the bride shows was that most of the surrounding states were either Catholic or Protestant by the 16th century. And they did not want to have their sons and daughters convert either. But there were a few instances, including the first false Dmitry, whom you mentioned, where either czars or grand princes or other members of the family married foreigners. Can you tell us a little bit about how the wedding ritual was adapted for that situation?
Yeah, there's a chapter in the book where I take three case studies and explore exactly what the implications of intermarriage, for lack of a better word, had on the way the rituals were performed. So I looked at the 1495 wedding of Yelena Ivanovna and Alexander of Lithuania. This is a case where a Russian dynast was marrying, a female dynast was marrying abroad and going to stay abroad and did not convert. In fact, it was a major point of the negotiations of this wedding was that Elena would not be forced to convert. She was cajoled a few times, but always resisted. The second was the marriage of Magnus, who was the brother of the Danish king, son of a Danish king as well, and a Staritskaya princess, a cousin once removed of Ivan the Terrible in 1573. And then the third was, as you say, the first false Dmitri. In each of these cases, and the reason why they're so really very interesting to study, is that the Muscovites had to hold on to some element of the traditional wedding rituals. And by that, I mean both the sort of the secular celebratory rituals that happen outside the church and around it during those 3 days, and the liturgics going on inside the church that was governed by that source I mentioned before, the Trebnik, or Patrebnik, the Služebnik, the service book. So in each of these cases, what you find is that the Muscovites are sort of telling us really what was the most important things that constituted a marriage. So for them, inside the church, very easy. A marriage isn't a marriage without a crowning. So you simply had to have that ritual. You had to have a crowning put over the bride and the groom. Certain prayers, said of them, usually three, uttered by the officiant, the priest. And then this dance of Isaiah, which is very famous from film and literature, where the bride and groom who have just been married, just been crowned, go three times around and on a loy or a little table in the middle of the nave of the church while a certain hymn is sung. That's key. And we find that that element in the wedding, even when we have heterodox spouses. When we look outside the wedding, we find that there are a number of things that the Muscovites consider really essential too. So for example, it's rather humorous that in 1495, when Yelena Ivanovna is sent to Vilnius to marry Alexander of Lithuania, very important marriage diplomatically in terms of bringing peace to these two warring neighbors, the Muscovites send all the various accoutrements of a traditional Muscovite wedding with them. And the Catholics in Lithuania have really no idea what to do with them. So they send a stallion, a horse that the groom is supposed to ride during processions. But there won't be any processions. And the groom looks at this horse and said, "Oh, this is a nice horse. I'll keep the horse, but I'm not riding it at the wedding because where would I ride it?" Because the Muscovites were just thinking in terms of how the layout of space inside the Kremlin called for certain processions from palaces to churches and back and forth. Those didn't happen in the way that the Muscovites anticipated. They furthermore sent traditional Muscovite clothing, including for the groom. They sent him other gifts of fabric, icons, a cross and chain, which he had really no use for, both at the wedding, but even afterwards. This is a Catholic. He really had no use for an Orthodox icon. So what we see is sort of a miscommunication, a misunderstanding on the parts, or an enormous assumption, if you like, on the part of the Muscovites on what this marriage is going to mean. You know, we can take another example of this. In 1573, we have Magnus coming to Novgorod to get married to a Staritskaya princess. And there, the wedding is in two parts. There is a Protestant minister and there is an Orthodox priest. But the bride is the only one actually allowed inside the church. The groom and his minister, are sort of positioned out in the anteroom and they're not actually allowed into the church. So when she performs the Dance of Isaiah, she goes around it by herself. And the service is physically separated by a wall, the wall that separates the nave from the antechamber, right? So Orthodox churches have three sections. There's an antechamber, there's a nave, sometimes called the actual church, and then there's the altar, which is more than just the altar table. It's everything east of the iconostasis. The bride isn't going to be in the altar. She's going to be in the nave. And typically so would be the groom, of course. But here in 1573, he wasn't allowed in. So the service had to be separated by a lot of space, and certain rituals could only be performed by the bride. And then the third example, just quickly, was the first false Dimitri. And that was a bizarre moment. You won't find a stranger wedding than that, because they had already been married by proxy in Lithuania. And so the wedding that was performed in Russia, in Moscow, it's unclear what it was. The Lithuanians thought it was a wedding, or sort of a revival of vows. The Muscovites thought it was the actual wedding, not something preliminary. The Muscovites understood that what happened in Lithuania a year before had been merely the betrothal service, and what was happening here in Moscow was the actual wedding, the crowning. So there was that bizarreness there, where nobody really understood what the other person was doing. Moreover, there's a coronation inserted in between some of the services that sort of just installed for the bride. The bride is crowned, and the traditional wedding service is interrupted so that this coronation could happen. And I argue in the book that this was actually a kind of clear reason why the false Dimitri just simply had to go. Not just that he married a Catholic who remained a Catholic, but it was that he had himself, he was the choreographer, altered a service, the purpose of which was to integrate the bride into the elite, the wedding. And he mixed with it a service that is designed to elevate the bride, the coronation, elevate her over everybody else. And these two services, inartfully slapped together, worked at cross purposes. And so my argument, and it may be a stretch, but I think it's right, is that this ritual abomination, if you like, really did set the stage for what was going to happen in the next few days, where the tide turns against the first false Dimitri, and he'll be executed. It'll be grisly, in a grisly way. So all these three sort of episodes show us that the wedding service, both inside the church and outside the church, contemplated, assumed Orthodox brides and grooms. And that when you didn't have that, and sometimes you weren't, you had to make adjustments. And what adjustments were made are very important, because they tell us what's most important to the Muscovites at the time, what elements of the services inside and outside the church they simply could not do without.
I think we've covered most of the high spots here. I want people to hear that we've left out most of the fun stuff, all the dirty tricks that were played on the brides, and the things that Peter the Great did to show that he wasn't going to live with the old ways, and the miestnichestvo, which is a placement system by birth, and how that played out in the wedding ceremonies. And so they're going to have to go to the book and buy the book, or at least borrow it from their libraries, so that they can find out all that good stuff, and the gift giving, which was had all kinds of implications that we're not going to have time to get to. I'm going to ask you now if there's one thing that you want people to take away from it, the book and your study of weddings.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because as this interview itself shows, I'm one of those people who can't decide which of the themes are more important, so I talk about them all. I guess pulling back as much as I can, I would say that there really is a language that ritual and ceremony speaks. And it really is the goal of this book, as opposed to the first book on bride shows, which is also about a ritual, but this book really is attempting to wave a flag over this theme of rituals and urge my my colleagues to think more about how other rituals might tell us more about this society that was so reluctant to articulate in ways that we want them to, what they thought and what they were trying to achieve at various moments in these centuries. This is a book about ritual. It happens to be set in Muscovy. It happens to be set in the early modern period. But ultimately, my hope is that this book by my colleagues will be read as a contribution to this larger literature, which really is exploding right now in other fields in the early modern period. I guess what I also would say, going back again to my early comments about John Clive, is that I hope that the book is a good read. There are fascinating stories. There are amazing personalities. There is dramatic change over time that is charted in this book, and a very narrow theme, of course, weddings, but it shines a lot of light on other themes. And so what I hope too is noticed by readers is that, I've attempted to make the book appealing and accessible, even as I get very, very close into the documents, into the sources, and talk about watermarks and talk about different versions of documents, which can be, eye-wateringly boring. But I've attempted, and I hope it's noticed, and maybe it won't be, maybe I'm fooling myself, but I hope it's noticed that, history can be written, even in a technical way, on technical topics, in a way that is readable.
I found it very engaging. I thought you did a great job. And what are you working on now? Are you going to go on with rituals?
Thank you for saying that, by the way. I do have a few projects. I have on the horizon the idea of producing a book of these documents, a diplomatic edition of the documents themselves. A collection hasn't been actually published since the 1780s, so it's high time someone coming along and actually produced a better edition of them with an index and all the other apparatus. But actually, I'm moving in a different direction. I've started working on a sort of intellectual biography of Prince Semyon Shkovskoy, who was an early 17th century intellectual. In fact, I suppose, that he was sort of Russia's first secular intellectual. And so what I'm doing now is I'm gathering all of his writings, and I'm starting with the sources, just like I did with this, and trying to figure out everything he wrote, where the originals are, what's been published, what hasn't been published. And then at some point I'll read it. Right now, though, I'm just trying to get a grasp on the range of his interest, and it's an enormous corpus of work that he wrote on, and he's important. He's important because he wrote on a number. He was a consultant, let's say, on a number of key issues of his own day, brought in by the Tsar, for example, on weddings. When the Tsar was trying to get his daughter to marry a different Danish prince, and there was some pushback because. In the 17th century, there was the thought that this Danish prince would simply have to convert. That wasn't an issue in the 16th century, but in the 17th century, it became an issue. And the Tsar brings in Shkovskoy to say why that isn't true. And so he writes this lengthy discussion of baptism and intermarriage. By the way, citing a few of the examples we just talked about of intermarriage. He's fascinating to me, and he's also an old name because, my old dissertation advisor, Ned Keene, thought he had written some things. As you know, the correspondence between Kurbsky and Ivan, he thought Shakovskoy had written. That's one of the reasons why I stayed away from him in a long time. As a Keating student, people might have thought that I was just trying to revive that argument. Certainly not. But now, 25 years removed from all of that graduate work, I can return, I think, more safely to Shakovskoy. So I'm very excited about it. It'll be a very, I mean, weddings will be there. Marriage is there. He marries himself multiple times, causing a scandal. So there will be some utility to what I've been doing the last few years, but this is new. This is different.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Russ.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, this was really fun.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I'm C.P. Leslie, and today I've been talking with Russell E. Martin about the Tsar's Happy Occasion, Ritual and Dynasty in the Weddings of Russia's Rulers, 1495 to 1745, for New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Like us on Facebook, search for NB History, and follow us on Twitter at New History Books. If you do, you'll see each time we post a new interview. You can find out more about me and my novels at www.cplesley.com, where I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye until my next conversation on the New Books Network.